Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Blair. Today is Thursday, May 8th, 2014, and we haven't touched on Obamacare lately, and you know how much I love to talk about Obamacare, so I figured we'd swap
things around. I have an upset stomach, so
I think okay. It's covered.
Oh, all right.
So you're fine. Of course, it's going to cost you.
Right.
Unless you make less than 400% of the poverty level.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's a great deal, right?
Yeah, I'd go for that.
Anyway, there are a number of stories we've been collecting lately about Obamacare and haven't really touched on because we kept running out of time because we're having much more fun talking about things like the NSA and, the latest political stuff and so forth. But, it's time to get back to it. So, Bill, you're the one who digs up most of them. And the one I wanted to talk about first was an article you found essentially titled Affordable Care Won't Happen, which I thought was kind of an interesting title. Tell us a little bit about the article.
Well, if you recall back during, two campaigns, primarily the first one, Obama's campaign, he promised that the health care law would reduce average family premiums by about $2,500. Now, that obviously hasn't come true, and they've kind of waffled about it, saying, well, you know, normal increases always happen, and that's just the way it is.
It's like that Thomas got thrown under the bus or something, but go ahead.
Yeah. So a Morgan Stanley survey this month of health insurance brokers finds double-digit increases in both the small group, which is employer insurance, and individual markets, with some states seeing outsized spikes. The report says that the increases are larger due to changes under Obamacare.
No. Can't be.
Have to pay for somebody else's birth control pills or something.
My goodness, the things that people think of. But actually, I had a hidden agenda here. I really wanted you to read that article because I have a story to tell that kind of fits in very nicely with it.
Okay.
As you know, I'm the webmaster of the Nolan Chart website, which is a political opinion website for people from all political viewpoints to come and post their opinions on all the issues of the day and so forth. And we have one guy who writes under the name OC Jim. And he's actually the only one who's in the status category. This is based on the concept of the Nolan chart, which is what David Nolan developed some 40 years ago. It basically expanded the spectrum to more than just liberal and conservative, and it includes libertarian status and has a wider range.
That's NolanChart.com?
That's the one, yes. And we are done with the shameless plug, so thank you.
Okay.
But the reason I mention it is O.C. Jim posted an article just the other day on the site with approval, of course, because all articles have to go through approval, not for the content, but just to make sure they aren't, violating people's rights and stuff like that. And in this article, he once again was lauding Obamacare and deriding the, in this case, the Tea Party people for their opposition to it and so forth. And so I decided to leave a little comment at the bottom of his article, which, I sometimes do just kind of, mix things up a little bit on the site, keep things interesting, because sometimes, readership gets a little bit slow, and so I just try to keep things fun and interesting. So anyway, I posted a comment, and I said, well, essentially all that is very interesting, but, the fact is that the issue is more than just covering the poor, because that's what he was emphasizing, how much Obamacare helps the poor. I said, it's also about the cost for both the poor and for the rest of us. I said, my wife and I bought coverage from Anthem Blue Cross in 2010. That coverage cost us $275 a month. And under Obamacare, that cost has now skyrocketed to over $1,000 a month. If we fall below a certain income level, here's that 400% of the poverty level thing again, then about 90% of it gets subsidized. Otherwise, we're expected to pay full boat out of pocket, and that drives prices up pure and simple. So that was the gist of my argument. And he wrote back saying, well, the fact remains that affordable health care is a right for every citizen. It should be seen as an investment in people and should not be a profit of an enterprise. I'm not sure I believe in any of that, but okay, I'll respect his opinion. So I said, sure, the fact that it nearly quadruples my premium doesn't matter, right? If the goal is affordable health care as a right, then, well, my rights have been severely violated by Obamacare because my health insurance went from affordable to unaffordable in a 4-year period. Well, he wrote to me directly by email after that. And his email was really interesting because what he wrote was this: "Walt, I certainly would be angry if I faced that much of an increase in healthcare. Have you checked healthcare.gov? Their open enrollment for 2015 starts on November 15, 2014, but do have special enrollment." His sentence is not well formed here. "Do have special enrollment yet due to changes in your status or misinformation you may have been given? You can call an 800 number for information. Former providers notify you about canceling coverage that doesn't meet the guidelines of ACA, but do not inform you of other options. Several people I know have found that other options are much cheaper." So I wrote back to him. I said, "Well, Jim, OC Jim, I live in Connecticut, which has their own version of the healthcare.gov site, and yes, that's where I got the new policy. It was the cheapest one I could find. I got it from Anthem. That's the same company I used to have." And then I kind of let loose on him a little bit. I said, "Not meeting the guidelines," because that's the phrase he used in his reply to me. "Not meeting the guidelines is kind of a slick way of saying we're going to tax the hell out of you by ramping up your coverage costs in a huge way so we can pay for everyone else's healthcare while driving everyone's costs up." And then
that's
he wrote
the right
back
thing to do.
Yeah, I thought so, you know. And then he wrote back something that was really, really interesting. He basically said, "I should call my congressman and I should complain because I'm being badly treated."
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a fascinating comment to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wrote back to him again. I said, You don't get this, do you? My congressman already knows all about this. He supports Obamacare. Where I live in Connecticut, my congressman's a Democrat. I guarantee you he supports Obamacare.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't care about people like me because I'm not among the neediest people. Well, not yet anyway. But the way things are going, who knows how long that will last. And it's not just me who's being singled out. It's anyone who previously shopped smart and didn't expect a health care plan to cover every sniffle. Those are the people who are being singled out. The frugal shop, the ones who previously bought high-deductible policies and paid for simple doctor calls out of pocket, are the ones being singled out the most. Now I have a whole bunch of coverage I wouldn't normally buy. I have maternity coverage, which is great, except that if I ever get pregnant, it'll be a worldwide headline news story because I'm male, not female. I now have mental health coverage because you can't catch schizophrenia from a toilet seat or a public restaurant booth, so buying such coverage when you're mentally healthy is essentially throwing your money out the window.
I don't know. I think that schizophrenia coverage you could get. You could use that.
You
some other
get
kind of
anyway.
Metal deficiency. It's, you know. I mean, I know I'm crazy, so if I'm on the show, I guess you must be crazy too.
So I just kept going on and on about all of these different coverages that I don't need. I mean, I love this one. I now have pediatric service coverage, which is great, except I don't have children.
but it still covers, if you had children, then it would still cover them up to the age of 26.
Yeah, and I'm 57 and my wife's 60, so again, we'll have a modern medical miracle going on here. I mean, I'm in the age range now where I'm considered to be a health risk, right? Because now it's starting to get to the point where I could actually have something serious wrong with me, but it's important that I have that pregnancy coverage, right? The maternity coverage. This is just how insane the whole thing is. But I wrote all this thing to him, and then after I was finally done, I said, you know what, he's not going to read all this. So I finished off by saying, even if I type all this, I know you're not really reading it. But what the heck, maybe you might read it anyway. So I guess the point, the moral of the story is, even if you're talking to somebody about this subject who just doesn't get it, who hasn't paid attention to all of it, who's just listening to the propaganda and so forth, if nothing else, you can have a little fun. You can be respectful about it, but you can have a little fun, and maybe, just maybe, you can even educate somebody occasionally if they're listening. Maybe.
Could happen.
So I just thought I'd share that story.
Well, no, it's true that most people don't understand insurance. You know, they say, well, you know, I've had some, my family had some problems with cancer or whatever it was, so I'm going to buy insurance just in case. And so they don't understand that the amount of money that they're paying to the insurance company is covering all the treatments for people who are sick. Now, here's an interesting little footnote from that same article. There was one program that was part of Obamacare called CLASS, Community Living Assistance Services and Supports. That's for us old folks, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was supposed to be a significant portion of the laws officially scored when the CBO looks at, you know, what this is worth. Supposedly, it was going to result in a deficit reduction. But the problem was that it couldn't be self-sustaining, and that was a provision of the law. In other words, they couldn't offer any kind of community living assistance and have people pay enough to cover the costs of community living assistance, because once you get community living assistance, you're on it for the rest of your life until you die. And so why buy insurance when your insurance rates are going to be higher than the cost of the community living assistance in the first place? So that's gone now. That was part of Obamacare and just kind of disappeared because there was no way that they could the government could make any money about it. Now, we were talking about, you know, these various increasing rates, and the same study, the Morgan Stanley survey, has determined that the spending growth in insurance had been slowing for almost a decade before Obamacare passed. In other words, before they implemented this program to reduce the cost of health insurance, the rate of increase was slowing. Now it's increasing. So as a consequence, rates are going up. So it's a pretty mess.
The thing that I wish they had talked about in that source that you're citing is why this rate of growth was slowing, and even more importantly, why the pricing wasn't going down. And unfortunately, that source isn't likely to be one to talk about that. But it would have been really great if they had done that.
Well, I don't know. There are all kinds of factors. Like there were various, you know, the baby boomer generation wasn't a straight line. There were bumps and grinds along the way, and there were various programs that.
I realize that's like a double meaning there, right? There were bumps along the way, pregnancy
bumps. Well, not for elderly.
And I went through the grinds. I mean, geez.
So anyway, no, I don't know why the spending growth rate had diminished, but it could have been a consequence of generic drugs. It could have been a consequence of people actually going on diets so they didn't get diabetes. Could have been people that didn't have heart attacks, or they cut back on smoking, or who knows.
Actually, I think I can point you to a pair of much more obvious choices, okay?
All right. Okay.
The first one is look at the history of the federal regulation of medical care, and you'll find that there were a number of periods, especially in the last 50 years or so, where there have been significant changes that mandated more and more stuff.
Yeah.
And I think what you'll find if you look at that period of time that they cited in the article is that there wasn't a whole lot of new mandates happening during that period. So essentially, the market was catching up with past mandates, and it was starting to finally reach the equilibrium point.
The second
thing to keep in mind is that if you also take into account what the Fed does to the money supply and readjust, or not perhaps readjust, recalculate all of that as if we actually had a level steady money supply, I think what you'd actually find is that healthcare was going down.
That's possible. Yeah. I mean, well, in theory, I suppose what the administration would say is that when the 2007 depression came in, everybody got an upset stomach because they lost their job, and therefore the medical insurance costs went up. So it was the fault of the big bankers.
But more precisely, the Fed tripled the money supply.
Yeah, they had to do that. I mean, you got to save the economy,
yeah,
right?
That's how they save the economy, right? Yeah,
for sure. There, yeah,
that's what really drove the rise in pricing. Now, it's true that when you expand the money supply doesn't get shared equally. But then again, we know that healthcare has been a priority even before Obamacare came along. It's been a major priority of the federal government for quite some time. So. Yeah, the healthcare industry's been, shall we say, quite healthy. They've been making lots of money because that's what happens when you pump money in. And as long as that's the case and you're creating new money, that means a lot of that money is going to go into the healthcare industry, which is going to make it even healthier.
There you go.
You have healthier in that sense. You basically have higher prices.
Yeah, another number from the Obama speeches was that there were 30 million people who were uninsured and they had it covered, and that was the whole purpose of this program. Well, there's an interesting footnote from Rand Corporation. They say, well, there were only 2 million people who did not have health insurance that will get health insurance under Obamacare. The tax bill for that coverage, medical coverage, is $10 trillion over 10 years.
Hmm.
Now, I've got a calculator, and I figured out $10 trillion split among 2 million people who are going to get insurance would be $500,000 per person, $500,000. Now, that's over 10 years, so it's $50,000 per year. Mm-hmm. So what Congress could have done was just, you know, send everybody $50,000 every year, and then they could take care of their own medical costs.
Yeah, there is, of course, one problem with that. I've always found that to be a rather amusing idea that has been put out there, that it would actually save money if you just gave the money directly. But that little lesson, if you will, again, ignores the nature of the money supply and essentially where that $50,000 comes from. Because ultimately, sure, that money is not coming out of
tax. Well, not where it comes from, where what it's worth when you spend it.
Well, both, really, because one influences the other.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I am sympathetic to where the message comes from, what they're trying to say, but let's not try to blame all of this on the cost of bureaucracy. The cost of bureaucracy is important, but let's be honest, they couldn't do any of this, whether they're just giving it out of pocket to those people, $50,000 a year at a time, or doing it through Obamacare. They couldn't do any of it without expanding the money supply. There simply isn't enough money available in the tax revenues to cover it.
Hmm.
It's just not there.
Yeah. Oh, the RAND study, or maybe it's a different study from RAND Corporation, also found that only a third of the Obamacare exchange signups were from people who did not previously have insurance. They were previously uncovered, which is where they get this 2 million. It's actually 2.4 million.
That'll be interesting if somebody else verifies that one. I mean, because RAND Corporation is considered a right-wing corporation, so anything they say is going to be basically discounted by majority of people. But if somebody else comes along and verifies that number, that's going to be really interesting.
Well,
because now all of a sudden, who did?
McKinsey is another survey group that reported that 27% of those who signed up for coverage on the individual market, which is all they've done so far, were previously uninsured. So 27% of 8 million is still 2 million.
McKinsey, what kind of company is that one? I'm not familiar with that one.
It's a health care exchange among the various insurance companies. So it's biased. Okay, it's biased.
Yeah, it's definitely biased. Still, though, it's encouraging, but I think it needs to come from another source that the left will have trouble going wild about.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's just not going to get taken seriously. I'd say this is encouraging. And I think it's a good thing that they confirmed what RAND comes out with. But ultimately, it's going to have to come from a source that the major media will consider to be unimpeachable, which, of course, is a crazy concept, but that's the way the whole system works. So, you know, once that happens, like if something that was left-leaning came out with a figure like that, then all of a sudden it would be meaningful to people.
Well, the former Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said that 7.5 million Americans had started to enroll in the Obamacare exchanges. And the CBO came out and said, well, they started to enroll, but they didn't actually enroll.
I remember that.
Maybe 6 million will be enrolled at some point over the course of this year. But right now it is about 20% of those people who started to enroll never finished.
Mm. Yeah. Now, the other thing about Obamacare, of course, is that it has essentially guaranteed the insurers that they'll continue to make, I think it was like 15% or something like that, above their costs.
Yeah.
So that's basically coming out of the government. But did I see a headline here that suggested that that's currently an unfunded option?
Yeah, they didn't allocate any funds for that because they just assumed that all the insurance companies would be fine.
So essentially, when, it's not a question of if, when the insurance companies are finding that their costs are exceeding their revenue, that money is going to have to come from somewhere.
Yeah, well,
this,
yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's called a risk corridor program. And that is that they guarantee that the insurance companies won't lose money and they'll only have to spend 85% of their proceeds on actual treatment. Now, the Obamacare authorized that, you know, reimbursement or follow-up through 2016. But they didn't allocate any money for it. So according to the CBO, it's going to cost another $16 billion over the three-year life of the program. But because they didn't appropriate any money, they're going to have to find that $16 billion somewhere else. Now, I don't know exactly how they do that, but...
Well, I think we can guess pretty accurately. Already observed, they can't even pay for what we currently have in Obamacare out of existing tax revenue. They had to expand the money supply. They had to go deeper into debt in order to do that. So I think it's pretty clear where that money's going to come from. They're just going to do that more.
Oh, so the Fed's going to push a few buttons and they're going to buy $16 billion worth of health insurance for all the bankers?
Something along that line, yeah. You think I'm joking?
I think you're joking.
I'm not joking. I'm serious. I don't think it'll be that blatant. I think they'll cover it up in certain ways. I think they'll smooth it to make it look like it's all legitimate and so forth. But, yeah, I think that's eventually what will happen.
Yeah, well, they'll get it somewhere because it's very important that the insurance companies make money, because if they don't and they fold and they're not on the exchange and you go to the exchange and there aren't any insurance policies for you to buy, that's kind of like you're going to look a little bad politically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're not going to let anything prevent those insurance companies from making that money. Like you pointed out previously, they'll try to vilify them for making that money. But that doesn't mean that they're going to let them go under, because that would be damaging to the electoral hopes of the politicians. They can't let that happen.
Right.
I mean, they're really down to some very limited options here. They can either do the crazy thing that I was proposing and you thought was a joke, but I really think that's what they're going to do. They could try taking it out of existing tax revenue, but that means they have to put aside some major spending on something else, and I don't think they can do that. I don't think there's anything there they can do it with.
Well, there's all kinds of administrative finagling they can do. I mean, the IRS is responsible for collecting all this money, so they'll just... they'll just adjust the tax rates to cover that, you know, additional expense.
Yeah, except that one, yes, it's only $16 billion. Only.
Yeah.
We're using the words only and billion in the same sentence. Can you believe that? Sure, it's only $16 billion, but it's also only one little instance of where the insurance companies can, you know, basically take it in the teeth.
Well,
I think it's fair to say there's going to be more of them.
Yeah, I suspect it's more likely that what they're going to do is, number one, the insurance companies, when it comes up to October and they start the new website for employer programs, that the insurance companies will be allowed to increase the cost of employer-provided health insurance so that they'll make the money for this year, but they'll do it, you know, on the basis of the employer mandate rather than the individual mandate.
If, of course, they don't actually extend and delay the implementation of the employer mandate to, say, after the 2016 election.
Well, see, the employer mandate, they could make a lot of money on the employer mandate, because it's not a teeny tiny tax, like Robert said, for the individual policies. It's a pretty hefty amount. It's like $2,000 a month that the employer has to pay if they don't provide an Obamacare, you know, compatible insurance policy for their employees, assuming that they've got 50 employees or more.
But by the same token, they also have the problem that the moment that they implement the employer mandate is the moment when all of a sudden people start seeing their required contributions at work increasing.
More likely than not. More likely than not.
And that's the one thing that they really want to try to avoid heading into the 2016 election cycle. They want to get another Democrat elected president and even try perhaps to get back control of the House of Representatives if they can. I mean, that's always their major objective, right? So they're going to try to do that. They're going to try to extend it as long as they can.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. I mean, the thing is, if there's anything that could fix the system or make things more palatable for individual consumers, technically they have to change the law. Now, they're getting away with a lot of delays, but they can't bump the employer mandate ahead a year. So they can't get more money by moving it, you know, the deadline back to November 1st or, you know, October 1st or whatever it is. So they can't.
No, but they can avoid the painful parts for the employees by delaying the implementation of the employer mandate by, say, 2 years.
Yeah, it's possible. But see, they want the employer mandate because that actually generates revenue.
So the real tricky part is, can they find a way to force the employers to fork over without letting the employers pass along costs to the employees?
That's going to cost money, too.
Yeah. And now we're back to, how do you cover the losses by the insurance companies?
Right. Well, yeah. We'll find out. We'll find out how they're going to do it. Yeah.
I'm telling you, I think this is where it's going to go.
It can be done. Obama will find a way to do it.
Now, you also,
however, Mitt Romney had a problem. And Mitt Romney,
well, yeah, I was going to mention that one because you found something that kind of touches on this from Massachusetts.
Go ahead.
No, go. You go.
Oh, well, I mean,
my voice is failing anyway, so you got
various talk. Various states decided they were going to have a state exchange rather than just letting the feds running the exchange. And among those states, of course, was Massachusetts because they had all these years of experience with the Romney Care. And they had a system set up, and it was working just fine. And then they tried to tweak it so that it would work for Obamacare. Well, the whole thing fell apart. The Fed sent them $135 million to upgrade their program, but it just didn't work. Massachusetts ended up, for all practical purposes, with no online exchange at all. And as far as Massachusetts is concerned, it's unlikely they're going to have their website operational until 2017.
Oh,
and here's another delay. The Obama administration announced yesterday it would give Massachusetts an additional year to comply with some of the particulars in the Obamacare program.
And isn't it kind of funny that nobody seems to notice that it's Massachusetts, which already was running Romney Care?
Yeah.
And they still can't get the website for enrolling done? That's bizarre.
Well, because it's all kinds of new premium rating factors that they have to incorporate so that they can determine what the benefit is from the feds for people who are buying the insurance plans. And that they didn't have in Massachusetts. So they had to add that on. Well, they never got to it, so Sebelius, before she resigned, gave them an additional year to complete that portion of their website. The word is transition. The common excuse for all the variations they've done in the program is transition. And apparently there was some sentence in the law that says that the Health and Human Services Secretary has discretion to resolve transitional issues. And they took with that word, transitional issues, and ran with it, and that's why all these changes have been done purely on a bureaucratic basis. That's the way the law was written.
Yeah. Well, it's gotten to the point where it's so convoluted and so distortionary that almost anything that you say is going to sound extreme. I mean, it does. No matter how you spin the darn thing, it comes out as being lunatic asylum. Oh, well,
I don't know. It's good for some people. I mean, there are people out there who are certified health benefit advisors, and they're collecting $58 for every application that they process. This is
all right,
California.
Slow down. What is this advisor? What kind of advisor is this?
A health benefit advisor.
What is a health benefit advisor?
Well, you see, in addition to the actual cost of the program, Obamacare had allocated something in the neighborhood of $10 billion to facilitate the states in not only establishing their website, but also hiring hundreds and hundreds and maybe even thousands of people that were going to be facilitators. Okay, and the facilitators are those people who answer the phone when you call and say, this website is broken, I can't get my insurance coverage. And they say, oh, I'm a facilitator, I will facilitate everything, I'll be over there this afternoon and we'll fix it all for you.
So essentially, if you were signing up for the first time for health insurance, and there are some people who are fitting that bill, and you were calling into healthcare.gov or, you know, one of the exchanges and so forth, you were basically talking to a commissioned salesperson.
Exactly. Not only do they get $58 for each one they finish up, they get $25 every year you renew, which was a nice little benefit for various California charities, nonprofit community organizations that are helping people get affordable health care.
So was this only in California?
No, half of the $10 billion went to California, which is why California, you know, presumably was the best state in the nation in terms of getting enrollments. So they took half. New York took $3 billion, I think, for New York, and they kind of spread the rest around among the 20 or so states that have state exchanges. California burned through $5 billion putting together these facilitators and making sure its website worked.
So, in other words, it's another case of a federally created job.
There you go. See, if Obamacare doesn't make you feel better, at least it gives you a job.
Yeah. And this is basically a job that produces what?
Affordable health insurance for everybody in America.
So without this job, there'd be no affordable health insurance. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's time for a break. What do you think?
I think so, too, yeah.
Okay, I think it's past time, actually, so let's take one. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walt and Bill on this Thursday evening. And just a couple of little political tidbits we want to touch on. First one really isn't going to surprise anyone, but Bill, I guess you feel compelled to mention it anyway. It looks like Rick Santorum won't support Rand Paul. Why should we be shocked by this?
Well, Rick Santorum wants to make it perfectly clear that the Republican Party is not a Libertarian Party. It's a conservative party, and so he's absolutely confident that there's no way that the party's going to nominate anybody except a conservative, which means, of course, him.
That's actually an interesting point about the Pauls, both father and son, because their viewpoint is that they represent true conservatism, and they've been making that point for quite some time. So essentially, this is, I guess it's sort of a headline that foretells something we all knew was going to come, which is there's going to be a battle to see which side is the true conservative side in the Republican Party.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The Libertarians have basically taken over the American Conservative Convention of the Year, and they always, take a straw poll. And mm-hmm. Rand Paul or Ron Paul always win the straw poll. But the nifty little gimmick that they have that they can always throw at the conservatives like Santorum, who, you know, want the government to be involved in everybody's life one way or another. And that is the Ronald Reagan quote from an interview, how many years ago, 20 years ago, where he said that the heart and soul of conservatism is libertarianism.
Yeah, that was an interesting quote. It kind of has been forgotten over time, but yeah.
But, when they start, the conservatives start saying, we need another Ronald Reagan, and they say, oh, okay, we'll get one whose heart and soul is into libertarianism. Oh, wait a second. He said that? Oh, no, not that.
It is a little bit worth noting, though, that despite the fact that he said that, his two terms in office basically belied that philosophy. But nevertheless, he did say it.
Yes.
Another interesting note that came out, the smart gun. Now, it didn't get a whole lot of coverage, but I thought it was, well, I can't say amusing because the whole gun thing, I can't say it's an amusing issue. But it was, I don't know, kind of a surprising development in some ways, because apparently they come up with this gun that, I don't know how else to say it, it allows the authorities to decide whether or not it's going to work.
Well, it's not quite the idea. The idea is that when you buy a gun, you get like a wristwatch that you do you have to wear in order to activate the gun so that only you can shoot it, nobody else can shoot it. And there are other variations where you have to put your thumb on it, and it scans your thumbprint, and if your thumbprint matches, then the gun turns on, you can shoot it, but nobody else can shoot it.
But correct me if I'm wrong, because there is nothing in the Second Amendment preventing the banning of wearing of certain kinds of wristwatches, doesn't that essentially become a backdoor way to ban guns and supposedly honor the Second Amendment?
Well, it's the advocate is a New Jersey legislator, and the bill says that if anybody ever comes up with a smart gun that actually works, they don't have one yet, then they will require all gun sales in New Jersey to be smart guns. Now, that's kind of like saying, well, because they have rifles for hunting, we're no longer going to allow pistols to be sold, because rifles should be more than adequate for self-defense and for hunting, because that's, you know, the only legitimate purposes for having any kind of weapon. So, but the problem is that nobody's developed one, and the NRA and the other Second Rights Amendment people are screaming, yelling, and boycotting any store that carries a smart gun. So they're carrying on their own little campaign on the side.
Well, wait a minute. You said there's no smart gun in existence, and yet they're boycotting stores that carry smart guns?
Yeah, well, no. They are telling gun dealers who express any kind of support for smart guns or indicate that they're going to be carrying smart guns that if they do, none of the their members are going to be buying any guns, much less smart guns, from them.
Okay, so this isn't an indication that they're already carrying the weapons. It's rather what their intentions would be if such weapons became available.
Yeah, well, I mean, the argument is that even if it worked, and if it worked 99% of the time, that might not be good enough to defend yourself. When that 1% failure occurs when there's another guy pointing a gun at you.
Reverse form of Russian roulette.
Yeah, right. The other aspect of it is that when you buy the gun, and let's say I bought the gun for defense of my home, it's my fingerprint or my wristwatch that activates the gun. So if I'm out of town and my wife grabs a gun, it won't work.
What happens if the wristwatch's battery dies?
Then it won't work.
So essentially, those people who are pushing for the smart gun are basically banking on the battery working.
Well, they're banking on it not working. Because the objective is, well, okay, if you want to defend yourself, then let's make sure your kids don't shoot you or kill other people. Let's make sure people don't steal your gun, and that you still got it for your self-defense. And if you really have to shoot, we'll just hope and keep our fingers crossed the battery's dead.
Well, I have a stock tip then for anybody who's interested in this whole smart gun thing, because if it turns out that somebody develops a smart gun, buy EverReady.
Or whatever the battery is. Of course, there's a battery in the gun, too.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying buy EverReady stock, because batteries are going to be in hot demand. You got to make sure you always have a fresh battery in there, otherwise your gun won't work.
That's true.
That's true. Okay, enough of the fun and games of politics. Let's go to the fun and games of economics.
Oh, why not?
Different these days.
Why not? I'm going to skip the first item because I'm in a Boeing bashing routine. And,
well, that's okay. I mean, I don't mind bashing Boeing. I think that's quite all right.
I think so, too. I mean, if there is a name for the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about 40 years ago or 60 years ago, whatever it was, it's got to be Boeing. They are the biggest beneficiary of a lot of, you know, military-industrial complex spending.
Yeah.
But now Boeing does do something useful. I mean, they build airplanes, and you know, that's something that's necessary for you know, domestic air flights and things like that.
Sure.
And
yep.
If they weren't there, there'd be less competition. But what the government is doing is they are giving Boeing big bucks to sell their airplanes overseas. And the Export-Import Bank is the one that does that. They spent $12 billion, I guess, last year. Boeing got $8.3 billion of those loan guarantees. And this is not loan guarantees. This is actual subsidies to Boeing satellites, Boeing this, Boeing that. That they're getting from the Export-Import Bank in order to facilitate the sales of aircraft, you know, worldwide. Now, there's a separate section, which are loan guarantees, and there the biggest beneficiaries are Boeing, Caterpillar, General Electric. Those top three spots got $7.9 billion, $1.3 billion and $1.1 billion in loan guarantees. So they are guaranteeing loans that Boeing makes to, say, Saudi Arabia, to buy an airplane from Boeing. And the government, taxpayers namely, are the ones that guarantee that Saudi Arabia is going to pay back Boeing for that exported plane.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate for a moment and ask you the basic question. Why is this important?
Just as an example of how the military-industrial complex continues to grow. This is one program of dozens that benefit Boeing. And I think that's important. The military spending is going to private enterprises who are, you know, pursuing the government's goals.
So are you suggesting that Boeing wouldn't survive without the government spending?
It probably would not be the company it is today.
What would it be instead, you think? I mean, I know we're speculating here, but
it would be competing with a dozen other companies that would be manufacturing planes at a lower price. But Boeing can take care and monopolize the entire market because they've got government supports.
We finally got there. I was waiting for you to say lower price. You finally did it. Hooray!
Hey!
Because that's the key point. That's the most important point of all, regardless of what you think about whether or not we should be putting all this money into national defense when, you know, we really don't have that big of an issue with national defense. But, you know, when you think about the whole question of it, regardless of which side you're on, there's one indisputable point that everyone has to acknowledge if they want to demonstrate sanity. And that is that all the spending drives costs up. And here's another example of it. It drives the cost of airplanes up. And that's significant because that, I mean, it's not huge on the grand scale of things of Obamacare and do you have a job and all that kind of stuff. But it has a minor significance in that if you ever want to fly an airplane, well, that just adds to your cost right there. It's not all by itself. It's not the only reason that flight tickets are so expensive, but it contributes to it.
Well, you know, it's an odd thing that there is you know, all kinds of laws against monopolies.
Yeah.
But there aren't laws against the government picking and choosing companies that are going to get the benefit of all kinds of government expenditures. And that distorts the market.
And that is a creation of monopoly.
And they create a monopoly as a consequence.
It,
matter of fact, there's people who are interested in space exploration are probably familiar with the SpaceX company.
Mm-hmm.
And they've pretty much entirely privately developed their own boosters and their own delivery packages for the International Space Station and so on. Now, it's a fact that the NSA is paying them to do it, But nevertheless, it's a private company, and they're you know, they're doing creative things. Well, they had to sue the federal government because they were not allowed to compete to use their boosters and bid on sending military communication satellites into space because, guess what company had a monopoly on military satellite?
I'm going to get
Boeing. Boeing. In a cooperative venture with Rockwell, they have the exclusive monopoly on all military satellite launches. And so they get all the contracts, and SpaceX can't even make a bid. These are no-bid contracts. And so it's, again, another example of Boeing.
It's also an example, though, of how crazy the whole system has gotten, because we're talking here about monopolies created by government, and we're talking about a company, in this case the name of SpaceX, that wants to get in on the gravy train, and because they can't, they're accusing Boeing of monopolizing the whole thing. But ultimately what they want is they want to be somebody else who's getting the feed that helps support the military-industrial complex.
That's true.
Seriously, I mean, it's That's a no-win true. Situation. There's no way to win in this one.
Well, we could talk about other industries along the same lines. For example, Microsoft, when they first developed not Windows, but their MS-DOS, were able to persuade IBM to include them in a bid for a contract that provided billions of dollars for purchasing computers for the federal government. And, of course, IBM had the exclusive monopoly, and so Microsoft paid them lots of money to become the official operating system for the IBM personal computers that they wanted to sell to the government. And that was one of the reasons why Microsoft beat out a lot of the competition, was because they had the exclusive contract with IBM, and IBM had the exclusive contract with the federal government.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Now, all this is important, but it's also really small potatoes compared to the other piece of monetary news we have, because this is actually an extension, maybe I should call it the current incarnation of something that we talked about here on the Freedom News Hour starting about 3 or 4 years ago, which was the attempts by Russia and China to start moving away from dependence on the dollar as a reserve currency to the world. And you dug up an article that shows they've taken another step in exactly that direction.
Yeah. I mean, basically, they want to disengage themselves from reliance on the U.S. dollar as international currency. So what they did was Russia and China got together, and they announced that they were going to decouple all of their oil import and export in dollars. They were no longer going to quote prices in dollars. They were going to quote them in rubies or yen or whatever the. I guess they were also willing to take the European Union dollars, but they basically said that tens of trillion dollars of petrodollars per year are going to be denominated not in U.S. dollars, but in some other currency.
So essentially, this is the beginning of the end of what has been called for many years the petrodollar.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the dollar has, over the past 5, 6, 7, 8 decades, become the international reserve currency.
Right.
And the reason why China was buying all these bonds was because they needed backing, some kind of solid backing, for their yen. And their backing was the U.S. dollar. And it was a nice little game that the U.S. could control inflation of the dollar and could control, you know, the amount of currency in circulation, and therefore have some indirect control over the price of petroleum.
But of course, the other side to this whole formula is that since the petrodollar is a major basis for the U.S. being a reserve currency to the world, if and when, it looks like it's now a question of when, not if, the petrodollar basically disappears and no longer has the influence it used to have, that is pretty much the beginning of the end of the U.S. dollar being a worldwide reserve currency. And, yeah. and that may not sound like much, but that's pretty significant stuff because it means that the Fed and the U.S. government won't be able to get away with stuff that they used to be getting away with in very massive ways that, you know, other countries just couldn't do anything with. And a lot of that happened, for instance, after the financial crisis of 2008. They used their world reserve currency leverage to make it possible to bail out, you know, the banks that were too big to fail and all that kind of stuff, without making it appear in any way, that they were harming, quote, the dollar, unquote. The only way they can get away with that is because the dollar is a reserve currency. Take away the reserve currency aspect, and now all of a sudden it becomes very difficult to do that kind of thing without having immediate negative consequences. So a very significant tool, if you will, is being taken out of the hands of the government and of the Federal Reserve they've had and enjoyed for quite some time.
Yeah, it's a little bit complex in terms of what effect it actually has, because theoretically dollars are fungible. So you can take a dollar and convert it into a Russian ruble, and you can bid in Russian rubles for the oil that's being produced in Russia and have it transported to France or whatever. So it will be interesting to see what effect it has upon the exchange rates between the U.S. dollar and the ruble and the yen and so on. Not the yen. The yen is the Japanese currency. What is the Chinese currency?
It's the yuan.
Yuan, yeah.
Yeah, Y-U-A-N is the way we spell it in English. I'm not sure exactly how it's pronounced.
Yeah. So when you start seeing the exchange rates taking, as a consequence of this or a half dozen other things that are going on, you start seeing the exchange rates between the U.S. and the ruble and the yuan and so on and so forth start to fluctuate, then people are getting spooked. And that's going to be a real problem. Now, of course, there was a big ruckus in Congress about China manipulating its currency, which was exactly what the U.S. was doing. But the congressmen were upset that China was able to inflate their currency without buying more U.S. dollars to do the inflation.
Well, of course, that undermines our ability to inflate with impunity.
Exactly. I mean, the ideal circumstance was for China to buy, you know, $1.5 trillion worth of U.S. bonds, and then deflate the currency to the point where they're not even getting back their original investment in the U.S. bonds, and so that was the game that the Fed was playing with foreign currency, and China said, we'll do our own. Thank you. We'll just inflate and not bother buying any more U.S. dollars. That's why one reason why the Fed had to step in and start buying U.S. treasuries.
And that's a problem.
China wasn't
buying.
That's
a problem because the U.S. and the Fed could get away with an awful lot of deficit spending, of bailing out banks and so forth, simply because the rest of the world had to buy into it because of the nature of the U.S. dollar's role in the world economy. Mm-hmm. And now that China is pulling away from that and Russia is pulling away from that, and essentially signaling the long-term end of the petrodollar and therefore undermining the dollar as a reserve currency, that's a game changer. And that's not a small game changer. That's a really big game changer. That's where it's no longer possible to inflate like crazy and make it look like nothing's happening.
Hmm. And that's why the price of gasoline has gone up.
And it's only just started. Yeah. Very sad thing. Well, we got about 2 minutes left. We really don't have enough time to get into other topics. Did you want to bring up one little thing before we finish off?
Yes. We had talked a few weeks back about the various cases related to intelligence surveillance. And one of the, if you recall, I talked about three different cases, Katz, Smith, and Jones.
Right.
And I really regret that I didn't catch up on all the nifty puns that the various media have gotten, because the Katz case, K-A-T-Z, was the beginning of your reasonable expectation of privacy. So there was an article that caught my eye and said, I didn't use any of these feline puns. like, is the court allergic to cats? K-A-T-Z. Another story, dogs, cats, trespass, and the Fourth Amendment. Of course, dog being separate thing. It's raining cats and Jones.
Mm-hmm.
A case of sound and fury. Herding cats, the GPS tracking, and the society's expectations of privacy. Does cats still have nine lives? Is the question being asked. Of course, you get cat's cradle, cat's got your tongue, neutered cats, skinning cats, cat's pajamas, and while the cats are away, the NSA will play.
Well, now that you've let the cats out of the bag.
I missed that one. I write that down.
I'm afraid that brings us to the end of the program, but Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Certainly.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time.